The Russians are ready for round three. How about you? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead of tonight's final presidential debate, we hear how our election looks from abroad. The Russians see American politics this way.
This sort of wild, free-for-all, bemusingly anarchic system that allows for things like, say, the appearance and rise of Donald Trump.
We also check in with some political activists from Denmark. They're currently down south in Atlanta, knocking on doors in support of Hillary Clinton.
It is crazy to be here in this time. It's like being part of history.
Plus, the Canadian campaign to tell Americans that we're great and our overwhelmingly positive response. Those stories today here on The World. Thank you for being with us today. You know it, but you may not want to hear it again. The third and final presidential debate is coming up tonight. While many of us in the U.S. are going through campaign fatigue at this point, Russians apparently can't get enough of Trump v. Clinton. That's a word from New Yorker writer Joshua Yaffa, and we're going to kick things off today hearing from him. Yaffa is based in Moscow, and he says Russians often ask him to explain the American political system to them.
I think Russians, not just beginning with this election, have a kind of fascination with the U.S. political system. And depending on the individual's political leanings, what they think in a bigger picture sense about America and its role in the world, that can be fascination in a somewhat hostile sense. There are others who see in it this sort of wild, free-for-all, democratic, lowercase d, charmingly or bemusingly anarchic system, right, that allows for things like, say, the appearance and rise of Donald Trump.
Before this election, what did Russians find anarchic about American democracy?
Well, just the notion that you have different wings, different parts of the government at times in kind of open war with each other, right? You can have, you know, the FBI versus Congress versus the White House, and someone in the Senate has a different opinion, and that's all before we get into the question of local politics and how a governor might act in defiance of the federal government or a mayor in defiance of the governor. I mean, you know, you wouldn't find a governor of a far-flung Russian region acting in outright defiance of the Kremlin or Putin. You wouldn't even really find a mayor acting in quite an open, aggressive defiance and antagonistic hostility with the Kremlin. So the fact that that happens, well, it speaks to this question of Russians finding the American political system intriguingly anarchic.
I mean, I don't know who you're supporting. It's not really important. But you ever find yourself defending the other candidate to underscore to Russians that, yes, democracy is imperfect, but still better than all the other forms of government?
Sure. And I think no matter what, the unpredictability of the American political system and certainly of this election, if nothing else, there's an instructive lesson in that just in what a kind of vibrant democracy can produce, because that sort of regardless of your political allegiances, I think is something that you can find healthy or worth taking note of in American politics.
Joshua, we've heard so much about the kind of admiration between Trump and Putin. Trump has now announced that if he wins, he's going to have a sit-down with Putin before the inauguration. From your vantage point, is there any evidence that Russia wants Trump to win?
There certainly was a lot coming from state media, which is as good as an indication as any of the mood in the Kremlin. And over the summer, you did really see a pretty strong push by the Russian state media acting as kind of boosters here in Russia for the Trump candidacy. Now, with 1 month to go before the election, I think that the real political professionals and officials in the Russian government read the same polls as do political pundits in America, and they most likely see that the window to victory for Trump is narrowing and are beginning to come to terms with a likely Clinton presidency. They might have wished for the wholly unconventional bull in a china shop candidate of Trump, but if they don't get him, right, I think that they're pretty clear-eyed about that and are beginning to think about what a Clinton presidency might look like for Russia.
Well, you talk in your New Yorker article about an interesting theory about what motivates Putin as far as the U.S. goes. As one Russian defense expert told you, Russia has to constantly convince the U.S. that it is a little crazy, i.e., maybe even ready to use the bomb. So what's your advice on how the next president should deal with Putin?
It is my sense from looking into the issue over the past couple of weeks and just over my course of several years of living and reporting from Russia that the difference between rhetoric and action in Russia can at times be pretty wide. I think it's probably not worth reacting with panic, alarm, trepidation, emergency response to each and every outburst of the Kremlin's.
Joshua Yaffo with The New Yorker. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
With less than 3 weeks until voting day, both campaigns will be picking up the pace as the finish line approaches. There's even a group of young volunteers for Clinton who've come all the way to the U.S. from Copenhagen. They're in Denmark's Social Democrat Party, and I've got two of them with me right now, Lasse Kuvang and May Jensen. So, Lasse, tell us where you've been so far, and where are you now?
Yeah, hey, nice to meet you. We just came from Miami, where we've been canvassing, you know, knocking on doors, and we've been phone banking. And now we are in Atlanta, where we're going to go to the college later today. And, of course, to this evening, we're going to watch the debate at a watch party with the Hillary activist here in Atlanta. The big difference from Denmark into the U.S. is that in Denmark, almost everyone votes. We have a turnout at 90%. So when we go campaigning in Denmark, it's convincing voters to vote for our party, while here in the U.S., it's more like mobilizing the Hillary voters. So that's a big difference for us in this campaign. But we definitely went knocking some doors.
Have you encountered any resistance from Trump supporters who might see you as, you know, foreigners meddling in our election?
Yeah, not that much. We've been lucky so far, but it might happen.
So, May, I'm just curious. You've come all the way from Denmark to help get out the vote for Hillary Clinton. Why'd you do this?
Yeah, that's true. I did with 40 other DSU members because it's a really important election, not only for the U.S., but for all of the world. The consequences if Hillary is not elected president would be, yeah, devastating.
So I find it interesting the way you phrase that. If Hillary is not elected president, is this support for Clinton or really an attempt to stop Donald Trump?
Oh, it's both. It's like, yeah, we know that, of course, when we don't politically agree with everything the Democrats and Hillary Clinton thinks, but she is the presidential candidate from the party that is closest to our views of how U.S. should be led politically, and that's why we want to support her.
And back in Denmark, I don't know if there are people who support Trump, but have
Not
you
many.
Had that debate? Do you find Danes who support Trump, and how does that conversation actually go?
We don't have many Trump supporters in Denmark. Of course, there are some, but even the right-wing parties in Denmark, you know, they politically agree with the Democrats. They don't support Trump as a presidential candidate. So it's more like debating the pros and cons of Hillary. The majority of Danish people want her to be the president.
So, Lasse, what's at stake in this U.S. election as you see it?
I'm afraid that if Trump's going to be the president, you'll have a U.S. who are less concerned with the rest of the world. And when it's concerned, it's maybe in a more aggressive way. I really hope that Hillary is going to be president because the way she was Secretary of State handling big international issues on the diplomatic way, like she did with the Iranian and like she did with the Russians, that's just the way for the U.S. to be involved in the rest of the world. So that's a lot at stake in this election for me as a European watching the election.
What is it like being in the U.S. at this important time, but a crazy American campaign season?
Yeah, well, I think you said it. It is crazy to be here in these times. It's, you know, it's like being part of history. I hope like being part of the good kind of history, of course. It's also, I think I speak for all of our group when I say that we have this urgent feeling that we need to do something. Like if we can contribute just a little to getting Hillary elected as president, it would be amazing. Like it's not possible for us to just sit back home in Denmark on our hands and not do anything. So it's really wonderful to have this opportunity to experience this country. For me, it's the first time here. I've never been here and it's crazy and amazing and everything is a lot bigger than in Denmark. And it's also just amazing to have the opportunity to be part of the campaign, to be canvassing, to see all this, see how it's done in the U.S. So it's very great.
May Jensen and Lasse Kuvang, members of the Social Democratic Youth of Denmark, speaking with us from Atlanta. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's clear that many around the world feel like they have a real stake in this election. Others are just trying to figure out what the heck is going on. Here's one example explaining Donald Trump's precarious perch between his fan base and the Republican Party leadership. Sometimes an outside perspective can help us understand it all a bit better. Here's my BBC colleague Ali Makboul reporting from Wisconsin.
WTAQ News Talk Sports. Yes, I'm going to talk about presidential politics, including Donald Trump returning to Green Bay.
Jerry Bader, a conservative talk show host here in Green Bay, Wisconsin, is suddenly losing fans at a rapid rate. And he's getting abuse from other Republicans.
Over the years, I have become accustomed to vitriol from those with a liberal worldview. They see me as the enemy. I'm not getting that same type of vitriol, that same type of you're the enemy, from conservative listeners who used to send me the greatest emails in the world because I won't support Mr. Trump.
So how do you answer those people who say you are letting Hillary Clinton in through the back door?
It doesn't matter if you don't think Donald Trump is any better. And this our depraved candidate somehow was more palatable than their depraved candidate. He is denigrating those women who have accused him of sexual assault. He's suggesting the United States U.S. presidential election is rigged. The suggestion that the process itself is being manipulated is just unprecedented.
Well, as far as we can see, right around this huge convention center in the center of Green Bay are supporters of Donald Trump. But it is at his rallies that the splits really become very obvious, because Donald Trump might be speaking here, but no senior Republicans are going to be on stage with him. So what do his supporters think about that?
That's no loss out of Trump's back. We only want the good people, the people that are going to make America great again. We don't care if the Republicans don't want to vote for him.
You supported the Republican Party in the past, right?
Yes, I did, because I believed in what they were doing at the time.
So if some of those senior guys say, look, we've got a problem with Donald Trump, does that make you think?
I don't care if they have a problem with him. We don't. We don't have a problem with Donald, because Donald wants to help us. No one's going to influence me. I read about what we need to know. We're going to help the veterans. We're going to screen people so they can't come in the United States. We don't want criminals coming in from other countries because they don't want their criminals.
He stands for more issues than the Republican Party, the Democrat Party. So he's focused on trade and immigration and making America great again.
We don't need them.
We don't need Republicans.
We do not need them. We don't need the traitors.
This is why we're all here, is because these career politicians, they need to go.
We're tired of power and greed.
Whether it's Democrats or Republicans.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. There you got it.
Inside the convention center, this Wisconsin crowd made it quite clear what they thought of the current Speaker of the House and fellow Wisconsinite Paul Ryan, who's not been fulsome in his backing of Donald Trump.
We are going to win the state of Wisconsin.
When the man himself appeared, they lapped up his expansive promises and claims the election's rigged. It may not affect the Trump base, but the unease of senior Republicans in backing him maybe just one factor contributing to undecided voters feeling he'd be a liability as president.
That was my BBC colleague Aleem McBool reporting there from Wisconsin, giving us his outsider eyes on the Trump split in the GOP. You're with the world. For the next few minutes, let's talk about Catalonia, a place we don't often go to on the show. Catalonia is the triangular region in northeast Spain, right along the French border. For centuries, Catalans have been proud about their identity and their territory. In the Middle Ages, it was its own country, and many Catalans would like to have it that way again. So into this fray steps Liz Castro. She's originally from Western Massachusetts, but she ended up falling in love with Catalonia. She married a Catalan and became a key activist in the Catalan independence movement. Liz, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So the obvious question, how does a woman from Western Massachusetts end up fighting for Catalan independence?
That's it's kind of a long story. It starts, my great-grandparents were born in the south of Spain. They didn't know what Catalonia was, but they were very poor. They emigrated to the United States in 1907. And I was always interested in this Spanish culture that was part of my family, just on my dad's side. So I wanted to know about Spanish. And at Berkeley, California, there was a class in Catalan. And I took that class and was interested in the language. And I really wanted to go there and understand why, since most of the people in Catalonia speak both Catalan and Spanish, how do they choose speaking one or the other? What you know, makes that happen? And I moved there in the 80s, and I loved it.
What was it about it that you kind of just like fell into and loved?
Well, there was, first of all, when they found out that I spoke Catalan, they were immediately welcoming. Catalan is like this doorway to the culture and to the people. And everybody's part of, you know, the Human Tower Club or the Stick Dancing Club.
The Human Tower Club. You're going to have to just like explain that real quick.
Well, they create these amazing human towers. They can be as high as 10 stories tall.
Right.
And they it's kind of embody this part of Catalan culture, which is that everybody has a place. Everybody can bring their piece to the project to make this amazing human tower work. And it's not only restricted to the people who are building this crazy thing. You have to Google human towers.
I'm just really curious, the differences between Spanish and Catalan. Like, I need to go to the barber. How would you say that in Spanish and how would you say it in Catalan?
In Spanish, it's tengo que ir a la peluquería. In Catalan, it's achdana la peluquería.
Wow.
So it's tengo que ir achdana. Pretty different. There are many words that sound what people from here would consider sound like French.
Right.
Manjar, parlar, or manger and parler, which are different from Spanish, which are comer and hablar.
So
pretty different.
So make the case for us in English about why Catalonia should be independent.
Catalonia should be independent. So basically my mission, you know, ever since I've known Catalonia, is to explain it.
Right.
And to translate it. I do a lot of translating into English on Twitter, on social media, on Facebook, and you know, press releases and anything that I can translate so that people outside of Catalonia can know why they should be able to have this right. Why should they be able to have this right? Because they consider themselves to be a people, a nation, and they want, just like, you know, the Americans in before the Revolutionary War, they wanted to feel represented, and they don't.
You've written a book called Many Grains of Sand, a source book of ideas for changing the world, tried and tested in Catalonia. It kind of sounds like a whole earth catalog with a Catalonian point of view. What is the idea of the book?
Well, the book came out of the fact that so much Spanish media tried to act like this whole independence movement was a plot or a manipulation by a right-wing party to control power. And they kept saying it was the president who was brainwashing people. And I knew that it wasn't, that it was actual real Catalan people saying, we want to vote on this. We believe in democracy, and we want to be able to choose our own future. And so what they did was they said, you know, maybe we'll go to Brussels and we'll have a demonstration there. It's a crazy idea to go have a demonstration 1,000 miles from your house. But they did, and they got 10,000 people to go there. And they didn't actually get a lot out of it, except that it helped people realize that there are other people interested in this movement.
Here's one thing that is very Catalonian, is pulled right from your book, and would seem to be a part of your activist toolbox. Cassolada, what is that all about?
Cassolada is actually originated in Chile, cazurolazo. It's banging pots from your windows to express, you know, your desire to do something. And that happened before the November 9th, 2014 referendum, when the Spanish government said, you're not allowed to have a referendum, you're not allowed to have a non-binding poll, you're not allowed to even have a participatory process. And people said, no, we're going to vote anyway, and you can listen to us as we bang our pots. We're going to go and we're going to vote, even if the Spanish government says it's illegal. And they did.
Well, why is Spain so determined not to let Catalonia be free?
Oh, that is a very good question. I think partly it's pride. I think they feel bad that Catalonia doesn't want to be part of Spain. I think it's a long history of a unitary government. I think it's conquest. You know, they conquered Catalonia and made it part of Spain, and they want to keep it that way. I think it's also an indication of a very young democracy that doesn't really know how democracy works.
Here's the thing, though, especially this year we've seen, and this is a question I've been really dying to ask you, with Brexit and with the Trump candidacy, the world seems to be kind of falling between the globalists and the nationalists. And you're in an even, shall I use this word, balkanized situation where you're looking at the territory of Catalonia looking for independence. I'm just wondering how it feels right now to be on that side of things.
Well, but it's you know, when we talk about nationalism, I think sometimes we don't realize our own nationalism. Like, what's the difference between nationalism and patriotism? Catalans aren't nationalist in an exclusive way at all. The definition for a Catalan is somebody who lives and works in Catalonia. This is a welcoming people. It's not about keeping people out. It's about choosing your own future.
How do you want to be a part of that future of Catalonia, Liz?
You know, I love living in Catalonia. I love the community and the importance that they put on the connections between people. One of the most remarkable things that I've experienced in the Catalan independence movement was when they did the Catalan Way. The Catalan Way was this human chain, 250 miles long. That's the distance between, more or less, between New York and Washington, D.C.
They like building things with people.
They like building things with, well, that's exactly it. They're people that's based on connecting people.
So what did this chain do?
Oh, it was amazing. So the idea was to create this Catalan Way, this human chain, 400 kilometers long, and to do that, they had to have people sign up online with their first name, their last name, and their ID number. And people were willing to do that. 453,000 people actually signed up.
Wow.
The crazy thing about the human chain was that when we got there, you know, the whole point of it was to attract attention from the world. But when we held each other's hands, 1.5 million people along this chain, I think we really proved to ourselves that we had this mobilizing ability, this organizational capacity, and this, and people were happy. It's not a demonstration where people were yelling and angry and no, like you think of separatists, you know, like the Basque or like whoever, that, you know, have a war. No, these are people who say, this is democracy. I want to have my voice heard. And there's a lot of us and we believe and we're going to make this happen. It was really powerful.
Are you more of an activist for Catalan independence than your husband?
Yes, I am. I am. I don't know why exactly, but I think partly because I do the English translation a lot. I think a lot of it is about being American. You know, I believe in democracy. I believe that, you know, you should be able to vote for things and to decide things by voting. And Spanish democracy is really, it's not the same. For me, it feels like a way to give back to this community that's been so generous to me.
Liz Castro, Massachusetts Catalan activist. I don't think we're ever going to be saying that again on the show. She's also the author of Many Grains of Sand, a source book for ideas for changing the world, tried and tested in Catalonia. Great to meet you, Liz. Thanks for coming in.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. The election got you down? Cheer up. Some Canadians have launched a campaign to tell us how great we are. And some Americans even wrote back to say thanks.
Some of it made us laugh, but some of it would get us really teary-eyed and we realized, wow, we've hit a bigger chord than we maybe even realized.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Mosul offensive is now in its third day. Iraqi government forces are leading the push to get Iraq's second-largest city out of ISIS control. Nearly 100,000 troops, including Kurdish fighters and various militias, are said to be taking part in the offensive. The U.S. is providing both ground and air support. Residents of Mosul have been advised to lock their doors and show a white flag while the fighting rages around them. Mustafa Atrushi is originally from Mosul. In 2006, he and his family had to flee the city, but he still has relatives and friends there. He joins us from Duhok, 45 miles north of Mosul. How difficult has it been for you, Mustafa, to be in touch with your friends and family in Mosul recently?
It's been very difficult, especially recently, since ISIS, they shut down all the communications and they're trying to block any words coming out or coming in. I've recently talked to a few friends, and just yesterday I talked to one of our relatives that live in Mosul. Actually, they said, we almost barricade ourselves in our homes. We stock supplies and whatever resources they needed. But they say we're hoping this war will finish before our supplies run out, and then we don't know what we'll do. Some people expecting two scenarios. They say, in the worst case, what if this war will take very long time to liberate Mosul? What will happen to the people who are living, who are barricade themselves inside their homes, scared of going out? And other people say we're hoping that this war will finish very soon, and they see signs that ISIS is fleeing Mosul, and the senior leaders, they already evacuated their families.
We've been hearing ominous stories about what ISIS might try to do to residents of Mosul as they flee, as ISIS flees. There are rumors that ISIS will try and booby trap whole blocks of the city. What have you heard from your friends in Mosul about that?
They say all the strategic locations are booby-trapped by ISIS, and there are more personnel on the rooftops of long buildings, such as snipers and suicide bombers. My friend, actually, he lived in a residential area where there is nothing important there. He said our location is much better than other area which has strategic location, buildings and locations.
So you left Mosul in 2006. Your older brother worked for the U.S. Army as a translator. What prompted you to leave?
You know, anybody who worked for the U.S. government and basically any allies of the U.S., he will be a target for the terrorist. And we as a Kurdish family living in Arabic Sunni city, who is one of their family member working for the U.S. Army, it's quite a danger for us. So that's why they executed my uncle at my presence, actually, and me, my little brothers, and two of my other cousins. They stopped us in the middle of road, four masked men. They told my uncle to dismount of the vehicle. They executed him, and they told us, tell your family, rest of the family, to leave. Otherwise, we'll start targeting more of you.
You witnessed all of this along with your younger brother.
Yes, I witnessed all this along with my youngest brother. His name is Sharif, he is currently living in the United States, and along with other my two cousins, which is their fathers who was executed.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Yeah. You've still got family in Mosul, right? I mean, what are your personal concerns about their life right now?
When I talk to them, they sound very scared. You know, they go to the rooftops to get phone signal, and very bad phone signals. They go to the rooftop and they lay down on the rooftop. They don't stand up.
Right. And I was going to say, how dangerous is it to go to the rooftop while there are ISIS fighters all over?
It is actually. They make phone calls only to inform their beloved and they're still alive and they're okay. And then they close the phone and hide it somewhere in the house. It's very dangerous to keep a phone because ISIS has banned all the phones. And if they catch somebody with a phone, most likely they will kill or they will fine or whatever they've been using as rules for banning their phones. And also satellite receivers. He said we have a little satellite receivers. We put it on the rooftops. We cover it with a little bit of cloth, only making a little bit space so we can get signals. But he said even that is too dangerous for us. But he said we still have it.
So if you had to guess, what do you think the future of the city is going to be after this assault?
There are actually two options. It's either ISIS leadership will collapse and they will be defeated and they will run in chaos. And hopefully the city will be liberated soon with less casualties. Or ISIS are preparing for this war for the last 2 years. I don't really know.
Mustafa Atroshi from Mosul. He's now in Dahuk. His family is still in Mosul. Our thoughts are with you. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
One thing's almost certain in war. Civilians will end up fleeing the fighting, often in large numbers. This year alone, the U.S. will settle close to 85,000 refugees from across the globe. Many have been ending up in Boise, Idaho. So many, in fact, that the city now has a special police officer assigned just to the refugee community. We sent the world's Jason Margolis to Boise to get the story.
I went for a ride along with Officer Dustin Robinson with the Boise Police Department. I was waiting for a cop car to come pick me up, but much to my disappointment, he showed up in an unmarked SUV, and he was wearing a coat and tie. He wants to put the refugees he works with at ease.
Police cars can look intimidating to someone that's been traumatized by law enforcement or military before, and the same thing goes with the uniform. Looks very paramilitaristic. You have your firearm fully displayed.
Robinson keeps his concealed under a sport coat. His job is to build relationships with Boise's growing refugee population. Close to 800 have come over in the past year, mainly from Congo, Syria, Iraq, Nepal, Somalia, Myanmar, and Burundi. They're resettled here because of the cheap housing and low unemployment. Robinson teaches classes to refugees about law enforcement, goes to banquets with immigrants, and spends time with African refugees who play soccer.
Go and sit in the park for an hour before their soccer games or their soccer practice and simply have a question-answer period.
Today he's visiting a corner grocery store owned by an Iraqi refugee.
Hi, how are you?
Robinson greets the shop owner's 7-year-old son.
Robinson offers the boy a sticker, then the dad comes to the cash register.
I'm Officer Robinson with the Boise Police.
Yeah.
Robinson has a shaved head and a goatee. He's tough-looking, but he's also super friendly. After some casual conversation, the shop owner starts to open up. He tells Robinson about problems he's been having.
I'm coming morning. I am see for my tires. Every tire's a front. I think for knife.
Your tires were slashed.
Yeah.
Were destroyed.
Yeah.
The man also says somebody threw sewage on his picnic table in front.
Did you call the police?
No.
No.
These incidents happened several months ago. Soon, communication breaks down, so Robinson gets an interpreter on a speakerphone. Robinson explains how the police can help.
I will let other police officers that drive around this area during the night know what happens so they can watch the building for you. Yes.
All told, we're at the shop for about 30 minutes. The shop owner seems happy with the exchange. Back in the car, Robinson says this happens a lot. Refugees are afraid to come to the police, but open up to him. He's built some street cred.
In U.S. customs, police officers are oftentimes called by, you know, officer and their last name. But I get called Officer Dustin by almost every refugee that I come in and encounter with. And I don't know if it's just because there's a comfort and a trust level there, but I know that the previous refugee liaison officer was called Officer Shelley.
That's Shelley Sonnenberg. She hatched the idea for the refugee liaison position a decade ago. At the time, she was a community policing officer in a part of Boise with a large refugee population. She says some refugees didn't trust the police. Others didn't understand what they do.
In some of the cultures, for example, the Somali Bantu community, the elders took care of the problems. It wasn't a police matter. And it was difficult to walk in when they had always done things through an elder. And now you have a police officer coming in and deciding what the outcome's going to be.
She says police learned to respect what matters could be handled internally by the Somali community. And Somali refugees came to understand when the police needed to step in. Sonnenberg describes some other challenges policing refugees.
Some of the refugees came from actual refugee camps. And if something was important to you, you took it into your home at night and kept it safe. Well, in America, you have plants outside and chairs outside and bicycles outside. And that doesn't mean you don't want it. It's just, you know, perhaps decoration. And so those things were disappearing in some of the apartment complexes. And so they thought they had a theft issue when actually it was more of an educational issue.
So people were literally taking plants from each other?
It was more like wind chimes, you know, things that were pretty and maybe different and not something that they had back home.
By the numbers, Boise is a very safe community. The Boise Police Department can't prove statistically if crime has been reduced because of the refugee liaison officer, nor can they say if Boise's population as a whole is safer. But Sonnenberg can say this about increased outreach to refugees.
Well, this is how I look at it. I think that in the beginning when they weren't reporting, we didn't know crime was occurring, whether that's to them or by them. And how are we making a safer community if our head is in the sand?
It's clear that other cities agree with her. Besides Boise, cities like San Diego, Portland, Oregon, and Fargo, North Dakota also have special officers assigned to their refugee communities. For The World, Jason Margolis, Boise, Idaho.
Tomorrow, Jason's got another story from Boise. We'll hear from one of the refugees being served by the city's police force.
My name is Asma. I came from Syria, and I am the first refugee from Syria in Boise, Idaho.
More of Asma's story tomorrow here on The World. Let's make another election-related stop now. Hindus here in the U.S. have been a pretty reliable voting bloc for Democrats in recent years, but a new lobby group called the Republican Hindu Coalition would like to change that. The group held a charity concert and political rally this past weekend in New Jersey. It showcased Bollywood music and an appearance by the Republican nominee himself.
Under a Trump administration, we are going to become even better friends. In fact, I'll take the word even out because we are going to be best friends. There won't be any relationship more important to us.
Reporter Sonia Paul has been looking into the shifting political allegiances of Hindus and Indian Americans. She was at the event.
You know, it started off with couples dancing, and then all of a sudden, people dressed in Arabic robes, made to look like stereotypical terrorists, I guess, coming and shooting, but like their weapons were lightsabers.
They're attacking the dancers with lightsabers.
Yes, yes. I mean, I guess in a dark arena like that, a lightsaber, you know, looks cool.
It pops. But
yeah, and then, you know, these guys wearing SWAT vests came out and had to take them down. And then when that was over, they all stood up and the Star Spangled Banner started to play and the program began.
Well, exactly. Let's hear from Shalabh Kumar, the founder of the Republican Hindu Coalition. And here he is at the New Jersey rally describing the kind of person Hindus, he believes, want in Washington.
Ask yourselves, who truly represents you in Washington? Is it a president who celebrates Diwali in White House and next day wants to give a nuclear-capable F-16 worth $658 million to Pakistan? Or is it the party that wants to cut aid to Pakistan, declare them a terrorist state, and prevent them from acquiring nuclear-capable F-16s?
That would be Shalabh Kumar, founder of the Republican Hindu Coalition, also a big financial backer of Donald Trump's, and obviously they're playing to the fears of many American Hindus. So, Sonia Paul, what about the Republican Hindu Coalition, do you think, scans with what Donald Trump's base feels about the state of America?
The Republican Hindu Coalition is all about entrepreneurship and business and having a Hindu voice in public policy. But the question is, what kind of Hindu voice is that? In the same way that Trump, you know, tends to appeal to disenfranchised Americans, working class Americans who feel that the media has ignored them, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi very much played to that sentiment that, you know, we've kind of been left behind and we need to rise above and beyond again.
What did Donald Trump make of this small pocket of Hindu support?
He didn't quite have the cultural nuances that you would expect from a presidential candidate, like that line, I'm a big fan of Hindu and I'm a big fan of India. Big, big fan.
I mean,
Hindu is the name of a person who may follow Hinduism, but it's not the name of the religion. And even when he equates Hindu and Indian, you know, it is true that India is a Hindu majority country and that many Indians here in the U.S. are Hindu, but only about half of Indians are Hindu,
right,
according to Pew Research Trends. And that's something, though, that we don't necessarily have maybe the finesse in American society to also call out and distinguish upon as well. I mean, a large part of why the Republican Hindu Coalition is able to do what it has done and is doing is that we don't have much understanding about Hinduism the way we might evangelical Christianity or Orthodox Judaism, conservative Islam, but political Hinduism is something that most people haven't heard before. The root of the concern and frustration is what happens when few people speak for such a large population.
Reporter Sonia Paul, she's been looking at the political allegiances of Hindu Americans. Her work is supported by the South Asian Journalists Association. Sonia, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
Stick around. We've got some Canadians who are hoping to make you feel good about being American. You're with the world. Immigration is bound to be one of the subjects during tonight's presidential debate. Donald Trump certainly hasn't been shy about his anti-immigrant stance. And one idea he's targeted specifically, sanctuary cities that try to make life easier for undocumented immigrants. That's an issue that's very much alive in Brockton, Massachusetts, not far from our studio here in Boston. Lydia Jean Cott has our story.
Brockton is about a quarter immigrant, but it's also the kind of city where many families go back for generations. And recently, the city has been divided over a proposed ordinance called the Trust Act. It would prohibit local police from detaining undocumented immigrants on behalf of federal immigration authorities. And it was all set to pass. But then, Donald Trump started talking about sanctuary cities and threatening to cut off federal funding.
Block funding for sanctuary cities. We block the funding. No more funding.
Trump's words riled people up.
It's brought a lot of stuff to a head out there, and people are going nuts. Let's put it that way.
That's Counselor Tom Monahan. The fierce reaction from residents spooked him and the other city councilors, and they postponed the vote till after the election. Now, the proposed Trust Act is pretty much all anyone in Brockton is talking about. At a recent community meeting, an activist named Juliana Langley explained why the Trust Act is so important to her. She knows what it's like not to be able to turn to the police for help.
I have never, ever, ever shared this before, but I myself was undocumented, and while I was at Brockton High School, I was in an abusive relationship, of which I never, ever asked for help, mostly, and the only reason was because my boyfriend was undocumented.
Langley didn't report her boyfriend because she was scared that they'd both get kicked out of the country. Something like that couldn't happen if this new ordinance passes, which irks Kevin Kernan. He's a lifelong Brockton resident who also attended the meeting. He feels that undocumented immigrants are breaking the law, the proposed Trust Act, he says, which has helped them get away with it.
This country is based on working hard and earning what you get. And if you're going to give stuff to people to make it easy for them, then why would they want to do anything else?
Kernan is not alone. And Donald Trump's tough immigration rhetoric has emboldened others to speak up, like this insurance agent.
Craig Pina, I'm an activist with No Sanctuary for Brockton.
The No Sanctuary for Brockton people claim undocumented immigrants commit more crimes than U.S. citizens, and that creating sanctuary cities is dangerous because they harbor violent criminals. Donald Trump and other opponents of sanctuary cities have made the same charge. But in fact, studies consistently show that immigrant communities have lower crime rates than average. All the same, the fear persists. Pina says he and his allies have been putting intense pressure on city councilors.
People are calling them, threatening to picket in front of their house. They're calling, saying that they've supported them, these councils, for a long time. They'll never vote for them again if they support this.
Meanwhile, the other side is mobilizing as well. An immigrant rights group met with city councilors in a church to persuade them to vote yes on the Trust Act. A woman called Maria quietly spoke at the front of the room. She fixes roofs for a living and has 5 kids. She said that every day she goes to work with her passport in her pocket, so if she gets deported, immigration officials can send her straight to Ecuador without having to stop by her house first, where they might find her kids. She doesn't want them to get deported too. As she was speaking, a woman in the audience started to cry. She slipped out of her pew and rushed out, letting the door slam behind her. The intensity of the meeting got to Councillor Tom Monahan. As he was walking out, Monahan said he had no idea that the immigrants who live in his city are so afraid. But he's always supported the spirit of the Trust Act, he says. He just also worries about its impact.
It was a good idea at the beginning. I didn't think it was a bad thing originally. Then the ordinance came out. I was a little nervous on it, but we're trying to clear things up.
In the meantime, the vote remains on hold, and everyone is waiting to see what will happen after November 8th. For The World, Lydia Jean Cott, Brockton, Massachusetts.
Finally today, we're getting toward the bitter, and I mean bitter, end to the race for the White House. That's one way to think about the election ahead of tonight's final presidential debate. It's enough maybe to get you feeling kind of blue about being American. But that's where some Canadians have come to the rescue. Maybe you've heard about this. They've launched a social media campaign that's getting a lot of love online. It's called Tell America It's Great, and it comes complete with a hashtag Twitter account and a series of YouTube videos like this one.
Hi, America.
What's up, America?
Hey, guys. We're just up here in Canada talking about how great you guys are down there, and we thought we'd just send you a little bit of a love note.
We're big fans. We like you guys.
We know you've got some really big decisions to make. But as you're thinking about your future, we just want you to know that
you guys are great.
You really are great.
You invented the internet.
You guys are going to get humanity to Mars.
Sherry Walczak is co-founder of the Garden North America, the creative agency in Toronto that came up with the campaign. Am I right, Sherry, in assuming the Tell America's Great message is a response to the Trumpian slogan, Make America Great Again? You're basically saying, hey, you guys are already great.
Well, I have to say, when we first started with this idea, it didn't really start with that in mind. It was much more, as you can probably imagine, even though we're up here in Canada, we were inundated just with the same bouts of negativity over and over again and the craziness. And it actually more germinated with the thought of, is there any way just to inject a little bit more optimism and positivity? And one of my colleagues, my co-founder, started saying, well, maybe we, instead of layering on with all this negativity, why don't we think about maybe sending a little bit of a love note? And it started that way. And then, of course, you can see now there was a bit of a play on the notion of great, but it was actually our own discussion. We were thinking, why are they being told that they're not great? There are so many amazing things about America and Americans today, not just the past, but today.
How hard was it to reverse the negativity? Because I don't think of Canadians typically waking up every morning and thinking, yeah, America is great. You probably feel like the U.S. is like a 5-ton elephant always in your backyard. Am I right?
Well, you know what? It certainly can be a bit of a national pastime for us to poke fun or comment and, you know, as a way to prop ourselves up. But in the end, this had gotten so heavy. I don't even know if Americans realize how much the rest of the world is looking at this election and all of the antics around it coming from all sides. And it's pretty depressing.
What kind of response are you getting?
It literally has been overwhelming. And I think what was most amazing for us was that it was coming from both sides of the border. Our first hope had just been to engage Canadians, to start tweeting stuff out there and get it out to our friends. But the response from the U.S. was overwhelming, and it was the gratitude. You know, I don't mean to be schmaltzy or cheesy, but we started reading the feed, and some of it made us laugh, but some of it would get us really teary-eyed, and we realized, wow, we've hit a bigger chord than we maybe even realized.
What made you teary-eyed?
This generous commentary back on Canada, thanks for having our back. And you may not realize it, but this is exactly what we needed to hear. So it's been this big reciprocal kind of love-in.
Sherry Walczak, co-founder of the Garden North America, Toronto-based ad company. Thanks very much for, you know, making us feel good about ourselves again.
It's our pleasure.
And if you need even more love, you can see some other Canadians tell us how great we are. We have that video up on our Facebook page. Just look for The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow with post-debate analysis and much, much more. We'll see you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.